Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the end of August. This week, we are very happy to go on explorers at Anderson Lake State Park with our guide, naturalist extraordinaire Jeff Hammerson. We are also joined by our fellow nature lover and recorder Meg Amos, along with a special guest, my sister Nancy, visiting from Colorado. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, here is our mystery sound of the week, and it's one that Jeff recorded himself. It's a cool sound, isn't it? And Jeff, we'll play it again at the end of the program. You guys probably suspect what it is, but there's more to the story than you think. And Jeff is going to tell us about it when we end our show. We are here at Anderson State Park, and it's about a 20-minute drive south of Port Townsend. And it was added to the Washington State Park system in 1969. There's an extensive trail system, and it's a great area for day hikes or horseback or non-motorized bike rides. And it consists of a 496-acre day-use park surrounding a 70-acre lake. It's named for a relative of Amanda Anderson, who was a previous owner of the property. The lake is sadly extremely prone to periodic outbreaks of toxic algae, which often closes its water to recreational use. The lake is surrounded by warning signs and generally closed from May to October because of the health hazards associated with cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae. Dog owners need to be especially cautious to leash their dogs when enjoying the area and make sure that they don't drink the waters, as the toxins can be lethal. Speaking of which, we should probably start our talk talking about these toxins because they're going to impact our visit today. Jeff is a great lover of amphibians, and usually we would just be dashing down to the lake and dip netting straight away, but we can't do that now. So Jeff, do you want to talk a little bit about the toxic algae problem here?
Yeah, I guess so. It's a big inhibiting factor for what a lot of people like to do here at the lake, fishing, but for people who are interested in wetlands and aquatic wildlife, it kind of keeps us back out of the water. But the toxins are, you wouldn't really know it if you walked up to the lake and just looked at it right now, but the toxin level was tested about a little over a week ago, or maybe it was a week ago, and it was very high, dangerously high. So by looking at the lake, you can't really see that there's anything wrong going on. And that's a little scary because you could easily just assume it's fine. But it's pretty well known now since it's been since the, like, 2006 or 7, I think it was, that
that dog died.
Yeah.
And that was so awful.
Yeah. And so the testing now is found every year. This is developing into a dangerous situation. So the cyanobacteria produce the toxin. The main one that causes the problem is called anatoxin A, and it's a neurotoxin, so it interferes with all kinds of bodily functions and can result in paralysis of your respiratory system and all that. So really bad stuff.
Yep.
But the interesting thing I've been wondering about is this affecting amphibians, for example? Because that's one of the things I like to look for here. And there's nice populations of several species here. And through this period when the toxins have been known to be dangerous, there have been lots of amphibians here.
Huh.
And they're reproducing. And as a matter of fact, one of the best locations for the western toads that are here their breeding occurs right down to the boat launch, which is where they test for the toxins at that exact point. And there are also other frogs there, Pacific tree frogs and northern red-legged frogs. And they seem to be not affected, but we don't have anything to really like, well, what would it be like if the toxins weren't here? Uh-huh. So it's hard to be definitive about saying they're not affected.
Yep.
There have been some laboratory studies that show that amphibians can be negatively affected by these toxins when they're at really high concentrations. But I'm not aware of any field studies that have kind of tried to relate amphibian activity or reproduction in relation to toxin levels. But like I say, here it seems like there's no disappearance of the amphibians.
Oh, well, that's good
news.
They're
here, so that's, yeah. We hope to find some today when we take a little walk by the lakeshore without going in the water.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Is,
yeah.
That's a bummer, but...
I know. But this lake in particular is subject to those high levels because it doesn't have any way to flush out, right? I mean, it's pretty self-contained, and it's a small watershed. You were telling me how small
it is. It's only like
a
little less than 1 square mile, the latest calculation for the watershed for the lake. I mean, that's hardly anything. It's just what you see around the lake, basically. It doesn't go very far. And so that input from little rivulets that are mostly seasonal is pretty small. And then there's one outlet stream at the south end of the lake. And that has a small amount of outflow as well. And it could have been affected when they improved or built Anderson Lake Road that crosses that outlet mm-hmm. stream. It could have interfered somewhat, but there's not probably much difference, because if you look at the old topo maps, I was doing that this morning, actually, going back to the 1930s, and there's some maps from the U.S. Geological Survey from that period. And the lake the mapped part of the lake looks pretty much as it does now, so it hasn't really changed, I don't think, because of that outflow modification when they built the road. I'm sure there's been some small change, but it hasn't been anything like dramatic.
I was doing a little bit of research this morning too, and found a really great piece on this lake and the studies that they've been doing, the Washington Department of Ecology, on their blog site for the 19th of February 2021, did a piece just on Anderson Lake, and they did cores of the lake and found that it's really in the last 3 decades that they've gotten the increased level of cyanobacteria, right?
Well, that study shows that the cyanobacteria population has been pretty rich here, even going back 300 years. But what you're getting at is that the toxin-producing strains of those cyanobacteria have changed, so that in the last 3 decades, as you were getting at, the toxin-producing strains have proliferated. But there have been lots of different kinds of cyanobacteria here over a really long time.
Uh-huh. Because it's a closed system.
And part of the issue that always comes up is that this used to be a livestock grazing area, and the open areas of the park that are still, they're open now, they're maintained as, most of the park's forested, but there are some open areas. That was all grazing land for a period of decades in the early 1900s to 1970 or so. Well, when the park got established, mm-hmm. then that stopped. But so there was a lot of cattle manure and so forth that added to the nutrients that are sitting in the bottom of the lake. To have a lot of cyanobacteria, you need a lot of nutrients, and you need warm water. And so the nutrients here aren't getting washed in from like some other place. They're here already. They're in the lake bottom sediments. And they get stirred up, brought into the water column, and feed that cyanobacteria growth and the toxin production by those. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting that it's not like, oh, it's washing in from this. There's no remedy that's...
Uh-huh. And they're increased by increased temperature. So with climate change, we can expect that there'll be more of that rather than less.
Could be. So it was interesting studies they've done here, and it makes you scratch your head like, okay, where do we go if we want to get this lake into a non-toxic situation? Mm-hmm. There's no obvious solution for that. So people are still trying to figure that out. Just getting the basic information about which cyanobacteria are the problem and how did they get here in the first place? Why is it like just 3 decades ago this became an issue?
I love that they did a core sample of the lake. I mean, that you could see, you know, different layers and sample from a long time back and relate it to what's happening today.
Yeah, that study showed that because they could monitor well before there was any development around here, and then through this agricultural period when there was livestock here, there was a big pulse of cyanobacterial activity during that period when it was agricultural. And then soon as that stopped and the lake became surrounded by state park and protected from that kind of use, then the levels went way down to what they were well before the agricultural period. So then you would think, oh, well, then things should be okay now and better. But actually, they've gotten worse as far as the toxins go.
Well, that is all very interesting, and we'll just have to do future studies the way so many things are. We don't have the full answer, but we've got little hints of where to go with future studies.
Yeah, so one thing we can do is go down to the lake outlet today where you can actually get near the water without getting into it and without crossing any barriers, that's, you know, because the boat launch is pretty clearly marked off limits.
Yep.
That's just to actually keep, not that you can't stand next to the lake and enjoy it, but just make sure people don't get in there with their dogs on a leash or anything like that. So it's pretty clearly marked. But down there, we can easily be in an upland area and see what we can find, see if there's any
that sounds good. Let's
frogs
go.
Going out.
Let's
today.
Go on a little wander.
Got it. Well, we didn't have to go very far. We just started down the trail at the south end of the lake, and we have a little frog.
Isn't he a beauty, or she a beauty?
We can say it's an it, because at this age, we're not sure whether it's a he or she.
Oh, it's quite a gorgeous one.
So this is one that is a product of this year's reproduction. So last winter, when they laid their eggs, and they hatched out in the shallows of the lake here, and they turned into little tadpoles or larvae and have grown up and have already turned into, lost their tails and turned into little frogs, grown their legs.
So when they'll then be a year in this state, and then the next year they'll reproduce? How old do they have to be before they have eggs?
At least 2 years. For the females, maybe 3 or maybe even 4. Depends on the kind of the local situation here. I don't think anyone's really studied it at this particular site. It varies from as short as 2 years for some males to 3 or 4 years for females, and kind of on average.
And so to define it as a red-legged frog, I see it's got that salmony pale orange line along the top, and then red-legged is there underneath. Even at this age, you're getting a red cast to the underside of the legs. Is that what you look for?
Yeah, right. Unless you're red-green colorblind like me, then you
then
can
you
use other things.
Yeah,
exactly. So we're looking at a frog that's about 1.5 inches from the tip of its snout to the rear end of its rump, and its legs are twice that long.
Yeah.
And it was out here along the trail in the
shade. Grassy.
Yeah, it's kind
shade.
Of a grassy, shady area. And they'll do that. They leave the water. How far are we from the lake here? We're quite a ways. I'd say the nearest standing water is several hundred yards away. But they roam out into the woods and feed and grow all through the summer and fall. And Then once the winter hits, then they have to find a place to...
Well, they go under like logs and downed debris?
They will, and also underwater.
Okay.
So they'll, these frogs will often hibernate, if you want to call it that. It's really just a inactive period. It's not like mammalian hibernation, but for all practical purposes, it's the same. They're just inactive for the whole winter when it's really cold. And then if it happens to warm up a little bit, then they can become active. Around here, it's not usually that severe a winter, so they can get some activity. And then, as I said, they breed. Well, we call it the winter technically because, you know, the breeding might start before the vernal equinox, which is March 20-something.
Yep.
So they'll be done breeding by then sometimes. Depends on the year. If it's super cold year, then it might be delayed.
And will they vocalize as much as our Pacific tree frogs?
Yeah, but you don't hear them so much. They're not as loud, and they're kind of... They actually sometimes call underwater. So,
I think we talked about that, you know, a couple of years ago when you were talking about amphibians with us and how the sound is amplified underwater.
It certainly carries well enough for them to communicate that way underwater. Uh-huh. But it's kind of a grunting sound, and it doesn't carry very far.
Uh-huh.
Like the tree frog calls, you can hear them from... like a mile away sometimes.
Well, and they're so tiny. I mean, you just can't believe that they're so loud.
Yeah.
Well, how cool.
So I'm holding it, and it's stopped struggling now. And just kind of hold the legs, not the end of the leg, but kind of near the shoulder area. So if it does happen to struggle, it doesn't twist the leg.
Yep.
And then hold the other one kind of under my thumb, too. So you can see it well, and now we can just...
We can Let's see what happens on its way.
If we put it down where it's going to bolt for cover, or it's down on the ground.
It's a little stunned. Now it's hopping away.
6 inches, 8 inches. It's about a foot, 3 inches, 6 inches, 10 inches. These are how its hops are going. There's about a 10-inch hop, and it's heading over into the thick vegetation along the side of the trail. Now it's in cover, and we can't see it. All right.
Oh, nice. That was great. We probably won't even make it to the lake because we all are interested in so many things. And here we've got a Steller's Jay feather. And I haven't heard them yet, but clearly it's this beautiful blue, vibrant blue feather. We do get bluebirds here, but they not very much, and they are passing through. But we get quite a few Steller's Jays. You'll know them by their raucous tones. And I seem to see that I hear them especially in the fall at my place. Mm-hmm. Jeff, what about you?
Same. Mm-hmm. Around here, I know one of the neighbors, and they nested right near here. At least 1 year they did.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm.
But what's really cool about birds with blue feathers, so what we're looking at is a feather that's largely gray, but it has a very distinct dark blue band on one side of the vein, which makes it around here very clearly the Steller's Jay. But there's not one molecule of blue pigment in this feather. None. There's only melanin is the only pigment in this feather, which is a dark kind of gray or blackish color. So why is it blue? Well, it's only blue when we're looking at reflected light, because they're like little air bubbles in the microscopic structure of the feather here that you can't see so well with your naked eye. And there is that melanin. And we see it when it reflects through that those air bubbles. We see the blue. But take this feather, and what I'm going to do is we're going to look at it up through the sky so we don't have any reflected light. It's all coming through the sky. There's no blue.
Wow.
Nothing.
Magic technique.
There's no blue.
Yeah.
Don't move.
Disappears Nancy's completely.
Nancy's our photographer on this site. Oh, that's a really cool trick. I haven't ever done that.
And then you turn it back here where we're getting the reflection from the sky back to our eye, and now it's blue. And if it had blue pigment in it, you'd be able to see it this way.
It would always be blue.
It would be there, yeah.
Yep.
So that's what's cool. Blue is mostly a structural color, we call it.
So
you get in the right light and you're really blue and jazzy looking, but...
What is the purpose for that?
It's just to produce blue, it's a...
It's expensive, probably.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be... There doesn't seem to be a common pigment that produces that. I think there's some rare tropical birds that might have a little bit of blue in them that's pigment-based. But in this case, it's simply... What you do is build a feather that has air bubbles in it so that it reflects the light a little differently than a feather that doesn't have those bubbles. And then you get blue. And if you think about it, there are not that many blue birds around, really. Yep. It's kind of unusual.
Is that the only color that is...
Some greens structural. Are structural. And then think of the hummingbird's throat and forehead.
Yeah. I knew about that one.
You know, when you look at it from one angle, it might look...
Dark black.
Yeah, it looks dark or black, or it might look some shade of red. But then when you get that head and it looks at you and you've got that reflected light off
that
of it, it's
like,
boom,
magenta,
it's incredible how iridescent it becomes. And that, again, that's a structural thing too. Yep. So there's pigment and in a microscopic kind of air bubble kind of microanatomy, I guess you could call it, in the feather that gives that blast of color from the proper angle only.
Same principle as this,
really. Yeah.
We'll meander on and go a couple more feet. No telling what we'll find. Oh, and Meg noticed a little trail of ants. And you can clearly see where they've, like, chewed a little highway. And Jeff is down on his hands and knees trying to identify what kind of ants. What do you think?
I think they're the western thatching ant, the one that builds those mounds.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes the mounds are a foot or two high and actually sometimes several feet wide, and they last years and years. There's
Meg's getting them on her
I don't
feet.
See one right here, but they roam far and wide from their nest mound. And these are beneficial ants. They prey on insects and scavenge things. They're not like the kind of ant they're going to invade your house. And, you know, that's the Argentine ant usually that's kind of a pest in some places. But this is a part of the ecosystem as a little predator and scavenger.
And have they chewed this
clearly.
Highway
this
here?
Is, I mean, if we bushwhack, because what we're looking at is a clear path that goes perpendicular to the walking path that we're on, but into the thickets on both sides.
But into the thickets on both sides are nettles, so probably we won't be going too far afield.
Especially my bare legs.
I know, that's right.
So these will lead to a nest mound, or sometimes more than one, and they live in those, that's their home base, and there's one, I moved here 16 years ago, and I noticed one right away, and that one is still active.
Oh,
and it was huge then, and now it's even bigger. They can last decades. Colonies can have tens of thousands of individual ants that are in them. Sometimes I see these I stop and look at roadkills, of course, as a naturalist. And I ride my bike a lot, so I see a lot of roadkills up close. And these sometimes will scavenge there with other critters like carrion beetles and so forth. But these seem to be on a main highway of travel. Probably, so this is like a 6-foot wide stretch that we can see of their path. And probably we're looking at a couple hundred ants here, maybe.
Yep. We need to talk about the mystery sound of the week still.
Oh, yeah.
So let's hear that mystery sound again. Okay, Jeff, now that's the sound of a Pacific tree frog, right? And there is some controversy as to whether it should be Pacific chorus frog or tree frog, but you were telling me that the latest accepted definition is tree frog.
Yeah, that's the latest checklist. For many, many decades, it was called the Pacific tree frog, and then turns out that they're related to some other frogs that are called chorus frogs, and so there was like, oh, we should, because it's related to those, we should call it a chorus frog, and so it became the name for a while, but a lot of people objected to that because they don't feel it's truly that type of chorus frog, that it might be actually, there are some people have put it in a whole new genus of its own. But at any event, and there's some dispute about that, as taxonomists are we arguing about names, but the latest checklist that the kind of North American herpetologists, amphibian reptile biologists use is Pacific tree frog.
So. And you're saying in that recording there are actually two calling back to each other, right?
Yeah, and that recording is in the woods, almost a half a mile from the nearest water.
Wow.
So, and this is what you're going to hear. I've been hearing it for the past week, actually, in the woods, in the late summer and fall, that non-breeding calling, like the frogs are in the forest. They're not near the water, and it is not the breeding season, yet they're calling. So that seems really weird because we associate just with bird singing, the breeding season kind of connection. And the same thing is true with frogs. So these frogs are vocalizing sometimes 50 feet up in a Douglas fir, a red alder. Sometimes they're among the sword ferns on the ground, all kinds of places. I've seen them up on red elderberry plants, but the mystery is, why are they calling? And you can hypothesize, oh, maybe they're some sort of social interaction. Well, what social interaction? You know, because they don't, those two frogs were, seemed like one started calling and the other one started calling.
Well, we're going to have to save the reason behind that for part two. That's it for Nature Now for this last week of August. And thanks so much to Jeff for being our guide, to Meg for being our field recorder, to my sister Nancy for being our photographer. And thanks also to Nora Petrich for being our sound editor, and to all of you for listening. Listen next month and we'll have part two for you.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.